Our interest here is in Cavendish's last known experiment, when, in the summer of 1797, at the age of 67, he turned his attention to the crates of equipment that had been left to him, evidently out of simple scientific respect, by John Michell. When assembled, Michell's apparatus looked like nothing so much as an 18th century version of a Nautilus weight training machine. It incorporated weights, counterweights, pendulums, shafts, and torsion wires. At the head of the machine were two 350-pound lead balls, which were suspended between two smaller spheres. The idea was to measure the gravitational deflection of the smaller spheres by the larger ones, which would allow the first measurement of the elusive force known as the gravitational constant, and from which the weight, strictly speaking the mass, of the Earth could be deduced. To a physicist, mass and weight are two quite different things. Your mass stays the same wherever you go, but your weight varies depending on how far you are from the center of some other massive object, like a planet. Travel to the moon, and you will be much lighter, but no less massive. On Earth, for all practical purposes, mass and weight are the same, and so the terms can be treated as synonymous, at least outside the classroom. Because gravity holds planets in orbit and makes falling objects land with a bang, we tend to think of it as a powerful force, but it is not really. It is only powerful in a kind of collective sense, when one massive object, like the Sun, holds on to another massive object, like the Earth. At an elemental level, gravity is extraordinarily unrobust. Each time you pick up a book from a table or a dime from the floor, you effortlessly overcome the combined gravitational exertion of an entire planet. What Cavendish was trying to do was measure gravity at this extremely featherweight level. Delicacy was the key word. Not a whisper of disturbance could be allowed into the room containing the apparatus, so Cavendish took up a position in an adjoining room and made his observations with a telescope aimed through a peephole. The work was incredibly exacting and involved 17 delicate interconnected measurements, which together took nearly a year to complete. When, at last, he had finished his calculations, Cavendish announced that the Earth weighed a little over 6 billion trillion metric tons. A metric ton is 1,000 kilograms or 2,205 pounds. Today, scientists have at their disposal machines so precise they can detect the weight of a single bacterium, and so sensitive that readings can be disturbed by someone yawning 75 feet away. But they have not significantly improved on Cavendish's measurement of 1797. The current best estimate for Earth's weight is 5.9725 billion trillion metric tons, a difference of only about 1% from Cavendish's finding. Interestingly, all of this merely confirmed estimates made by Newton 110 years before Cavendish without any experimental evidence at all. So, by the late 18th century, scientists knew very precisely the shape and dimensions of the Earth and its distance from the Sun and planets. And now Cavendish, without even leaving home, had given them its weight. So you might think that determining the age of the Earth would be relatively straightforward. After all, the necessary materials were literally at their feet. But no. Human beings would split the atom and invent television, nylon, and instant coffee before they could figure out the age of their own planet. To understand why, we must travel north to Scotland and begin with a brilliant and genial man of whom few have ever heard, who had just invented a new science called geology. 5. The Stonebreakers. At just the time that Henry Cavendish was completing his experiments in London, 400 miles away, in Edinburgh, another kind of concluding moment was about to take place, with the death of James Hutton. This was bad news for Hutton, of course, but good news for science, as it cleared the way for a man named John Playfair to rewrite Hutton's work without fear of embarrassment. Hutton was, by all accounts, a man of the keenest insights and liveliest conversation, a delight in company, and without rival when it came to understanding the mysterious, slow processes that shaped the Earth. Unfortunately, it was beyond him to set down his notions in a form that anyone could begin to understand. He was, as one biographer observed with an all but audible sigh, almost entirely innocent of rhetorical accomplishments. Nearly every line he penned was an invitation to slumber. Here he is in his 1795 masterwork, A Theory of the Earth with Proofs and Illustrations, discussing something. The world which we inhabit is composed of the materials, not of the earth which was the immediate predecessor of the present, but of the earth which, in ascending from the present, we consider as the third, and which had preceded the land that was above the surface of the sea, while our present land was yet beneath the water of the ocean. Yet almost single-handedly, and quite brilliantly, he created the science of geology and transformed our understanding of the earth. Hutton was born in 1726 into a prosperous Scottish family, and enjoyed the sort of material comfort that allowed him to pass much of his life in a genially expansive round of light work and intellectual betterment. He studied medicine, but found it not to his liking, and turned instead to farming, which he followed in a relaxed and scientific way on the family estate in Berwickshire. Tiring of field and flock, in 1768 he moved to Edinburgh, where he founded a successful business producing sal ammoniac from coal soot, and busied himself with various scientific pursuits. Edinburgh at that time was a centre of intellectual vigour, and Hutton luxuriated in its enriching possibilities. He became a leading member of a society called the Oyster Club, where he passed his evenings in the company of men such as the economist Adam Smith, the chemist Joseph Black, and the philosopher David Hume, as well as such occasional visiting sparks as Benjamin Franklin and James Watt. In the tradition of the day, Hutton took an interest in nearly everything, from mineralogy to metaphysics. He conducted experiments with chemicals, investigated methods of coal mining and canal building, toured salt mines, speculated on the mechanisms of heredity, collected fossils, and propounded theories on rain, the composition of air, and the laws of motion, among much else. But his particular interest was geology. Among the questions that attracted interest in that fanatically inquisitive age was one that had puzzled people for a very long time. Namely, why ancient clamshells and other marine fossils